once more under the breach, dear friends.
Else fill up the wall with our English dead.
Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and...
Jeff McClure.
Together we are bald.
And we have learned through diligent effort and long practice to say our last names together.
Yes, occasionally.
Right.
When we are in top form, we can, in unison, say our names together. Yes.
Yes. Which is a lot more difficult than you might think it is, because we're in different places and there is a significant lag between one and the other.
Yes. If you've ever watched, everybody has, the 24-hour news channels, as they talk to each other across satellite and they say, "Hello, Janet, please proceed." And Janet sits there and looks very intelligent as she's holding her ear, gazing off into the distance for several seconds, and then she talks.
Right.
Yes. Live is not as live as it looks. Or maybe
it's not as live as it used to be.
And maybe it's deader. Live is deader than you think it is.
Well, digital live is different from analog live and biological live.
Yes.
And somebody could probably get a government grant and write a dissertation on that.
What do you do for a living? I'm a radio frequency biologist.
Yeah, I like that.
All right. We are actually economists, and we're here to talk to you about, get this, the economy.
Ta-dum.
We're also going to talk about some personal finance stuff, because we do a lot of that as well. The two of us are Jeff and Jake, just so happen to also be principals at another firm, or at a firm. It's not really another firm. It's kind of the firm that we're with, the Personal Wealth Coach, which is also the name of this radio program.
It's a whole nother firm.
It's a whole nother firm, yes.
Right.
Specific to the word nother.
Right.
Yes. So the Personal Wealth Coach is also an SEC registered investment advisory firm.
Which does not imply in any way that the SEC approves or disapproves of anything we're doing. As a matter of fact, given the opportunity, they would disapprove.
Yes, that is their job. And we're just happy that they don't disapprove of us tremendously.
Right.
In fact, I'm not sure that they've ever disapproved of us, which is not because they haven't approved of us, but because they haven't had enough notice of us, maybe? I don't know.
They looked hard.
Yeah. Right. So the SEC doesn't give us some kind of brand of approval. They're just our regulator. Now, we said that we're giving investment advice as a firm. That's something that's in the best interest of the client, putting the client ahead of us by far, all that good stuff. And we can't do that on the radio because we don't know you and you're not clients. And all of the privacy issues and all that good stuff if you are clients. So what we do instead is education, because we believe that if we educate people, hopefully they'll use it. It seems to have some track record, and that people that know more tend to make better decisions. I know this is weird stuff. There's got to be a study on this too. Do you have another disclosure for us?
Well, the information that we provide on this educational radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information.
Or unsaid information. We also do not...
I went into my radio voice to say that.
Yes. We also do not pay for this radio program. It's not a paid commercial program. We also don't get paid to do the program, which makes us... I don't know. Is that charity?
Pro bono.
We do advertise on the station for the program, as does the studio. We have all been advertising this for a long time. We've been doing this program together since 1998, and you had 2 years in advance of that where you were doing it on your own for an hour instead of 2 hours.
Right.
So we've been doing this a long time. Would you like to jump into what happened in the market this week? Because, you know, nothing major. If you look at the normal beginning and ending of the market, right, it looks like nothing happened. So obviously there was no excitement in the market this week.
No big thing. We follow the S&P 500. Well, we look at the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index as an indicator of what's going on in the market, because A, it's considerably more representative than 30 stocks in the Dow Jones Industrial Average, although less well known. And there are probably more accurate depictions of what goes on in the market, but nobody's ever heard of them and they don't update very fast, so we leave them alone.
Yes.
The S&P 500 stock index, and this, if you followed stocks, stock market during the week, you couldn't help, whether you were listening or reading about it. I mean, there's no way that I think you could not notice the fact that it was rather dramatic in its moves up and down during the week. It moved up at the end of the day after the Federal Reserve conference on May 4th, or press conference on May 4th. It moved up dramatically. The S&P 500 went up to about 4,300. And then the next morning, it fell off equally dramatically. But for the whole week, and this is, I must admit, when it comes Friday and I start looking, the market's closed on Friday and I start looking at the numbers, the entire S&P 500 lost 0.21% for the week, which is not really a loss. There were enough dividends paid during the week that if you counted the dividends, it didn't lose money during the week. It basically did nothing if you looked on Monday and you looked at the beginning of the day on Monday and you looked again at the end of the day on Friday and say, well, the market didn't do anything this week, which says a lot about how most people should monitor the stock market. The less frequently you look at it, presuming that you're invested for the long term, the less frequently you look at it, the happier you'll be. At least that's my opinion. Now, when it's going up, you may feel irrationally exuberant, but when it's going down, you may feel irrationally depressed. Anyway, looking at the numbers out for a little longer period of time, the market, and we had a little slightly different number in the newsletter because I recalculated it, but the market is technically down. The S&P 500 is down 13.97% from its high on January 4th, which means we're in a correction, and that should be no surprise to anyone. We're not in a bear market. The many, many, many signs that indicate a bear market is either present or impending are missing. I say they indicate, historically have indicated, is probably a more accurate statement. So it's kind of interesting. The other thing that's, at least to us, fascinating, and I must admit that I have a certain pleasure in seeing it happen, is that the value side of the market is doing significantly better than the growth side of the market. Now, the difference between the two is value stocks are, in this day and age, are associated with Warren Buffett. They're basically companies that, when you look at all the stuff they do and all the things, and if you were to buy that company without regard to stock market price or anything else, you just looked at that company and say, what's it worth if we broke it up and sold it? The stock price is at or below the breakup value of the company. Those are called value companies. And people look at what the company is actually worth, if you were to, in the real terms that we think of day to day, and say that's what's driving the stock price. Then there's another set of companies that are priced on what people think they might be worth in 5 to 10 years. Tesla is the most obvious one at present. But there's generally a lot of tech companies that fall into that category, some of which are actually losing money, which means they're not really, in a real sense, they don't have any value at all. But people think they're going to make a lot of money. So they bid the price up to astronomically high. Those are growth companies.
They're growth, being valued by the market based on what we expect them to do, or right, what the market expects them to do, and sometimes irrationally expect them to do.
A lot of the big companies, I say big companies, big names that were popular, like Zoom and so on, last year, and zoomed to the heights and did AMD and all kinds of places, not AMD, but the what was the movie company that went up so high? Anyway,
AMG, yeah.
AMG went up so high.
Not AMG, America, yeah.
Maybe it is AMD, something.
Not anyway. AMD, AMD is a chip company. It's a company that does movies. I think everybody right, else knows who we're talking about.
And the game company are down well over 50% from their highs. They have crashed. But the funny thing is that you don't see headlines saying, guess what, had you invested in all these really high-flying companies, you would be crying in your beer today. I think some people are crying in their beer. But the value side we follow using a mid-cap value index, CRSP mid-cap value index, for 1 year, for the week, it was up 0.64%. It is down about 4.8% from its high in January. It's down 1.12 for 12 months. By the way, the S&P 500 is now down 2.58% for 12 months. So we are definitely in a correction in the way you look at it. But it ain't bad. Now, the interesting thing in the market right now is the Treasury or the bond market. The yield on the U.S. Treasury note rose 7.3% to 3.143%. Now, that sounds like a tremendous amount, and it is. Again, remembering that a year and a half ago, it was at 0.5%. That's a heck of a rise. The S&P 500 bond index, which basically takes the bonds issued by the companies in the S&P 500 index, has fallen 12.39% this year. And here's where it's interesting. And if you've been following this, you probably have read about it. The death of the 60-40 portfolio, it's called in the headlines. Historically, or at least recently historically, a prudent portfolio for most investors has been 60% stocks, 40% bonds. Well, so far this year, the bonds in that portfolio, presuming we use that index, would have fallen about 12.5%. And the stocks in that portfolio would have fallen about 13.5%, which meant your whole portfolio is in the dumps. And the supposed assumed depended upon relationship where when stocks sold off, bonds rose and vice versa, just ain't there. And it's gone. And it's been going a long time, and there have been some headlines on this, and we can talk about it in more detail. The 40-year bull market in bonds actually ended last summer, but it's showing it's basically turning into a major bear market in bonds. It'll get there.
Yeah. And just to kind of point out real quick in a reference, because this is part of the market, kind of a longer-term perspective. If you think back to the big stock market performers from the pandemic era, Robinhood, Netflix, Moderna, Zoom, Carvana, Peloton, which is the exercise equipment company, Etsy, Clorox, and Domino's. What's fascinating here is like PayPal, for instance, is now worth less than it was in 2019. After having about doubled during the pandemic. Netflix is worth less than it was in 2019 prior to the pandemic, when it's now worth about $96 billion. This is roughly. It capped out at $306 billion. So we're talking about a third of the price. It's worth less than it was in 2019. It has more subscribers, but it's worth less. So some of this is overselling. And I think you mentioned this, or you were planning on mentioning the newsletter where you talked about the market being seen as undervalued.
Right.
That's
the Morningstar, actually earlier, before the market dropped a little bit, Morningstar estimated that the S&P 500 stock index representing the market was about 12.5% undervalued. That was before the market fell. So it's maybe a little more undervalued now, which is a good time to invest, by the way, although we're not making a recommendation to do so.
Yes, we don't really make a recommendation to invest or not invest on the radio program, except that what we generally tend to say is not to time it. If you have money to invest and you're being diversified, just as an educational point, when you have the money to invest is generally a good time to invest if you're doing it long term.
John Templeton, the best time to invest money in the market is when you have the money.
Yes. Because
which is a lot of truth in that.
People try to think about timing the bottom or the top, but if you look at history, if you timed it and you jumped in right at the top of the market in 2000, it took a while to recover, but you're doing really well now. And the same is true kind of at any point long-term in history, top or bottom, when you're getting in. If you're getting in for a long period of time, historically, it's just been a good time to get in when you had the money. So that's kind of important. And on the personal side, back to you at the market, though, stuff. I'm taking the show away.
Mine's perfectly all right. The I do want to mention something that obviously a lot of people have said, and that is if you hold a bond to maturity, you don't lose value.
Well,
yeah, you lose value. You just don't lose dollars. With inflation running as high as it is, you lose value because the dollars are worthless.
And that assumes that the bond matures. So there's default risk that if somebody ever says high yield bonds, the reason why there's a high yield is because there's a higher risk of default. They may not pay you back.
On the other hand, if you have a bond fund, it's really hard to hold it to maturity. And as a result, and there's a lot, bonds are just losing value in the market today. And they're losing value in more ways than I like to count. Some people get upset about that. Anyway, the Treasury yield curve, which is something we watch pretty carefully, is still positive. It's not intensely positive from 7 years to 30 years. It's only a little positive. It's very positive if you count in the shorter terms. But it isn't in an inverted position, which typically forecasts a recession. So that's good. West Texas Intermediate crude oil rose also. It is at $110.33 a barrel at about close of business yesterday. And by the way, the prices, if you look at the price right now, it's going to be a little different because oil trades 24/7. And so we just kind of look at it at the end of the business day. Why is it at $110 a barrel? Well, first off, we're burning a lot of oil. And if you don't think we're burning a lot of oil, just if you're living in Central Texas or living someplace else, go and stand on the edge of an interstate and watch it. Watch the vehicles go by and you say, yep, there's a lot of oil being burned there.
Yeah. I've got a report from the coast from my trip there and watching the petroleum cycle out there. So I'll let you continue this, but this is something to look forward to later in talking about the amount of wealth that's being generated in Texas for the price of oil. It hurts at the pump, but that money sticks to Texas and tends to come back into our economy.
I used to think in the other previous oil booms when the prices were up that the gas pump was a transfer of wealth from regular people to Team Boone Pickens, but he's no longer around, so I'm sure there's somebody out there.
Right.
Anyway, oil prices up for two reasons. One, we're using a lot of oil. But the biggest reason is the entity that produced about 7% of the oil in the world market, a place called Russia, the Russian Federation, actually, is basically being cut off from the world market. The Europeans are getting more and more serious about not buying oil from Russia. Places are getting blown up in various places in Russia, and the Russians are insisting that it's accidents that are causing it. And when you have the laws of supply and demand cannot be repealed even by the president of the United States, although several have tried it. Richard Nixon tried it. Other people have tried it. And in the law of supply and demand, when you have a high supply, when you have a low supply or supply shrinking even a little bit, and you have a high demand, prices go up. And they go up until the supply says, whoops, we don't need to buy so much anymore. Or not the supply. When the demand falls off because of the higher price, then it tends to stabilize. Or when the supply picks up because of the higher price. And the problem, and people have asked me this question, why do we not have a bunch of oil being produced in the Permian Basin and places like that?
We are producing it. It's
we are.
Up a lot, but it's not as up as it was in the past at this kind of price.
You can't just go out and turn on a spigot. There was a time in the history of oil when oil would just flow out of the ground if you turned the spigot on. Now you have to drill holes in the ground and you have to pump stuff in and you have to set up a lot of equipment and you have to have pipelines and you have to have trucks. All those require people and material, both of which are in short supply. So while the oil production is ramping up in the United States, it's ramping up slowly.
So I'll give you a year over a year, when we talk about the Permian Basin, which is mostly in Texas, there's about 335 rotary rigs out there. Now, rotary rigs aren't fracking rigs, so there's different numbers on that, but it gives you a good number here. 335 of them in action right now. 1 year ago, there were 229. So you've got about a 50% increase in the number of rigs working right now, which is a pretty good number. Oil prices have not come up 50%. they've come up a lot more than that. So as you said, finding somebody to work to get the rig started again, it's hard to find people to work. And people that were extremely happy to go and work in the oil and gas boom years got laid off at some point, and they didn't like that. Why would people dislike getting laid off? I don't understand this. I actually do understand this. It's silly that people would expect the same kind of a rush into that. We had a higher unemployment back in the boom years in the oil industry, so you could hire people anywhere and get them to go to North Dakota and live in a trailer. And by a trailer, I don't mean like a mobile home. I mean like a tow behind the truck teardrop trailer and live out there for 8 months, but get paid a lot of money. We don't have enough people to do it anymore. We don't have the people to hire. And those that would have been willing at some point, a lot of them got burned by the oil industry, and so they're not willing to go back. So it's another piece of the supply and demand. The supply of workers is down at the same time that the supply of oil is down. It compounds to high prices. This concept of where the prices are going there, we have a question from John. Are you done with the market?
Yeah.
Okay. We have a couple of questions from Inquisitor John, our faithful questioner. The first one is titled Stagflation. Are we entering a period of stagflation? Is it because it happens so infrequently, the last time in the 1970s, that the Fed didn't see it coming, or is it not used to managing it as opposed to a recession? Well, there's an easy answer to this, and that is, what is stagflation? Well, that's not an answer, that's a question. Stagflation is when you have a high amount of inflation and a high amount of unemployment at the same time, so that people aren't working and prices are going up. We're not doing that right now. We have a high period of inflation. The danger is that the inflation will sap the growth out of the economy, or that the Federal Reserve will make it so hard to get money that businesses won't be able to expand, and that will sap the energy out of the economy. So this is a different kind of inflation than the 1970s. The kind of inflation in the 1970s was wrapped around wages being ratcheted up regardless of what you were producing. And one of the things that the Federal Reserve is watching, that we're watching, there's an employment price index that talks about how the pay is compared to what inflation is. And recently, it's not keeping up with inflation. So that means that wages aren't going up as fast as inflation is. And we can see that in some other statistics. We can see that consumer debt went up more than we expected it to, because people still have to, or still want to, buy the things that they were buying. But it also says something about the confidence in the economy. So that consumer debt going up, that sounds bad, except that we're at a historically very low level of consumer debt. People during the pandemic spent a lot of money in paying down debt. So we're not anywhere near back up to where we were in 2019 in consumer debt. But we see that uptick, and we see that employment price thing. All of it means that the inflation we're seeing is not stagflation. So that is the long-winded quick answer is less long-winded. It's not stagflation that we're seeing right now. It is bad inflation. And I know it sounds like that's a quibble from an economist. You're talking about the difference between, I am experiencing inflation. Yes, but you probably have a job. That's the difference. And that is the difference that needs to be underlined here. This is still not fun, but it's not as unhealthy to the economy as the 1970s.
You know, there's another thing about inflation that has not made the headlines because it's not sensational. And that is, when we look at month-over-month inflation, in other words, inflation so far this year, we've had 4 months to go by to measure inflation. Inflation so far this year is running at about a 3.6 annualized rate. Now, I realize that you saw the consumer price index come in for the first quarter, or when consumer price comes in for the month or whatever recently, and they say 8% or something like that, 7.8 or 8.2. That is from a year ago. And if it were still running month over month, in other words, if in the first quarter, if you analyzed it, it was still running 7.8 or 8%, that would be something to be seriously concerned about. In fact, it's running about 3.6%, which is a lot less inflation than we had last year.
Yeah.
And it is trending downward, which means that if things continue as they are, and they probably, they look like they're going to at this point, as the year progresses, you're going to see lower inflation year over year. Year over year inflation is only, it actually is just an arbitrary measure. If you want to measure, you want to really look at inflation, look at it over a multiple year period. And the other side of inflation that you really ought to be aware of is for the past several months, 3-4 months, on a month by month, what has been the rate of inflation? And when you see, for instance, inflation at 0.3% for a month, you multiply that times 12 and you get 3.6% inflation. That's not for those math nerds out there, I know that's not precisely exactly correct, but neither is the inflation measurement exactly precisely correct. The other side of inflation that you want to look at, which is running even a bit slower than that, is the core PCI. And I'm getting geeky here when I say the core PCI.
Shouldn't we just call that the CPCI? That way people will have a longer and more non-functional acronym.
Yeah, and it'll make us pronounce. It'll make us sound like we know stuff that other people don't know. It's actually the PCE or PCI?
PCI.
Okay. Yeah, it's the index. That's right. It's the personal consumption index. The personal consumption index says not only what the CPI comes in and looks and says, okay, we have this fixed items that we look at, and we're going to look at the same ones every month because that's rigorous and that's really good. We're going to look at the same ones every month and see how the price has changed. We're going to call that inflation. The PCI looks at what people are actually spending money on each month and looked at the variations in price. And that is more realistic in many, many ways. And it is the one that you feel in your pocketbook in many, many ways. Then to get the core CPI, you pull out food and fuel. Why? Well, because food prices fluctuate tremendously, even from month to month. And fuel prices also fluctuate tremendously.
And to give a quick example of that, just because people, I get this question very regularly. What do you mean they fluctuate regularly month to month? Well, food is seasonal. Cattle give birth seasonally. They don't do it all through the year, except in very strange cases. Tomatoes tend to be born, in the same sense, seasonally. And this is fascinating. People miss this, but oil prices tend to be much higher in the winter than they are in the summer.
That's because when the oil is grown, there's less of it grown in the summertime than there is in the wintertime.
Well, there's more grown in the summertime.
Well, then the price should be lower.
That's what I mean. Summertime, it's lower, and in the wintertime, it's higher. But it's also cold, and so people are using it to heat their house, and it's not a very effective way of making your house comfortable to heat your house in the summer.
Particularly with tomatoes.
Yeah, with tomatoes, it's really a bad idea. But if you want to avoid petroleum products, you could invest in heating houses with tomatoes in the summer. And we've just gone on a very silly track. So the seasonality of these prices, it's not something that, you know, in today's era, we're kind of separated from the harvest season because so few of us do harvests anymore. We're working in some other industry completely. There's a very tiny fraction of 1% in agriculture in the United States. So when people say there's a seasonality to food, they're like, why? I eat the same amount every day. Well, yeah, but where you get it and who grows it and whether or not it's grown in a greenhouse or on a farm or whether or not the farm workers have COVID and all that good stuff, that's different seasonality. That's when disease seasonality. So you get these massive swings up and down in prices of avocados and tomatoes that are kind of predictable, and you can seasonally adjust your numbers. But if you've got it in the basket measuring inflation, it looks like we have these tremendous bursts of inflation. And why isn't the Federal Reserve doing something about this? They need to raise interest on tomatoes immediately. Well, wait. Yeah, They probably would if they could. Anyway, well, back to the PCE.
Well, okay, we can actually move on to, because it relates to that, to John's other question about the bond losses.
Perfect. Excellent.
John's question was, if the bond market is so large compared to stocks, why are the losses so big this time? And why didn't investors see it coming? Well, it's an interesting story. Investors did see it coming. We saw it coming.
We've been talking about it for months. It's just most people don't.
Actually, for years. The problem is that most people not necessarily most money is invested based on emotion. That's unfortunate or not fortunate, as the case may be, or whatever. People buy and sell based upon their personal experience. And we have a lot of people in the stock and bond markets right now who don't do careful research. They just do what their neighbors are doing, or they do what they
or have what's worked for
success
them.
With, or what's worked for them in the past. And very few people who are actively investing have as much experience as I do. My investing history started in the 1970s, which was back before the hills got dusty. And as a result, I saw a tremendous bear market in bonds that occurred in the late 70s and early 80s. As interest rates rose and rose dramatically. And I watched companies going bankrupt, insurance companies going bankrupt because they had big portfolios of bonds. I saw there were horrendous losses in the bond market and some in the stock market. It was not a pretty picture at all. The reality is that for the vast, vast majority of investors, and John, I suspect you're one of them, for your entire investing adult lifetime, interest rates have been falling. And as interest rates fall, bonds rise in value. As interest rates rise, bonds fall in value. Now, that's something that's taught in finance school. It's taught everywhere. But since most of the people, the vast, vast majority of people who are investing today, both in stocks and in bonds, have never seen the prices of bonds fall, they have this tendency to say, bonds are safe, the price never goes down. I have heard that literally said about real estate.
Yeah.
Real estate is a safe investment. They're not making any more land. Therefore, real estate is a completely safe investment. Well, between 2007 and 2009, people found out that might not be true.
Might not. And a lot of people found out that it really wasn't true.
And our memories are so short. We're back in that position now where people are basically, a lot of people are saying, buy a house because it'll go up in value, because real estate is the best place to buy a house. And the reason is,
real estate, it literally is the best place to buy a house. You are correct there.
Yeah, it's the best place to invest in real estate as well.
Yeah.
Well, to me, it's a very short period of time from 2007 to 2022.
Well, for you. But
for me.
For everybody else, it's 15 years, which is a long time.
It seems
like yesterday to me as well.
If a person is 35 or 40 years of age, it's been their entire investing lifetime.
Yeah.
Houses have gone up in value. Therefore, houses are safe and houses will always be safe and there'll never be another bust. I have seen, I think, 4 booms and busts in real estate. I have seen, I think, 4 booms and busts in oil. We're going through a boom in oil right now. I have a great deal of confidence. The closest I get to certainty about the future, that there will be an oil bust and there will be a real estate bust down the road somewhere.
They occur. I mean, throughout history, we have boom followed by bust, followed by boom, followed by bust. And they have long cycles, long being 15 years. And that we're right on time for this one. So people act like this is a surprise, and it is, unless you study history. George Santayana said, those who do not study history are condemned to repeat it. And they are.
Well, his actual direct quote, mm-hmm. Those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Close enough,
though. Close enough, okay.
Yeah.
So this concept of why don't investors learn from this? Some of them do, but the vast majority of people, you get this new generation of investors every generation that make the same mistakes as the last generation. And it's part of the reason why we have a radio program, honestly, because we really would like to see people learn from other people's mistakes rather than make them again just to make sure.
To give you an example of how bad the bond market is, I mentioned that the S&P 500 bond index was down about 12.5% from the beginning of the year. The article that John sent us, thank you for taking pictures of these articles, John. Long-term treasury bonds lost more than 18% this year. Now, if you take into account the fact that long-term treasury bonds were also losing money during the last 3 months of last year, they're now down more than 20%. So technically, the long-term treasury market is in a bear market. Long-term bonds in general are in a bear market. The whole bond market, if you want to measure it by any of the major, major indices, it's not quite there yet. It's down about 15%. But interest rates are, there's absolutely no question. I mean, the Federal Reserve announced interest rates are going to continue to rise. And I can tell you that across the board, they're going to continue to rise because they also announced they're going to shrink their portfolio of bonds. They're going to shrink their book, which means they're going to be selling bonds into the open market. And when you sell a lot, prices go down. And the Federal Reserve owns like 16% of the U.S. Treasury debt. And when they start selling those bonds into the open market, the price will go down and interest rates will go up. Promise. This happens. This is reality, folks. Right. And interest rates have got a lot further to go on the upside. And as they go up, bonds will lose money.
And we'll tell you what the Federal Reserve has said repeatedly. The Federal Reserve has said that they see a neutral interest rate at 3.5%. That's neutral. We're at 1% now. We just had a half point rise this week. And people are terrified that they're going to do it again, or are they going to do it again? Well, the Federal Reserve has been saying repeatedly, they're going to be raising interest rates. And they're going to continue to do it unless some massive shock hits our system, what they would keep it down. We're experiencing inflation. This is what you do when you experience inflation. You raise interest rates. You make the money harder to get.
The Fed actually hasn't said 3.5%.
Former Fed governors and individual Fed governors in speeches, acting Fed governors.
Well, they're actually a few days ago, one of them said 2.4% was the neutral rate.
So there's a spread, but the spread starts, that's like the lowest in that spread, 2.4%. We're at 1 now. That means we have to more than double the interest rates at the short-term area. That's going to hurt. People that don't expect it are going to be hurt by that.
We need to do commercials.
Yes.
I want to say something, but we need to do commercials.
This is a subject that we're very nerdy about, and we're probably not as entertaining as usual because this is something that people are actually getting hurt by. But we've got to play some commercials. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you have a question for us, we've got email addresses sitting out there waiting. Jeff@tpwc.com and Jake@tpwc.com. That's Tango, Papa, Whiskey Charlie, or The Personal Wealth Coach. We're going to play some commercials, and we'll be back on the other side with more of The Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and
Jeff McClure.
And you had something else you wanted to say.
Yeah, let's talk. I want to talk about neutral rates and so on, and what the Fed and why you use the 3.5% rate. And a lot of economists are actually saying that. And occasionally, as you said, people on the Federal Reserve Board have mentioned it. There's a lot of attention paid to the subtleties of what Federal Reserve governors say.
Mm-hmm.
And several of them have endorsed a series of interest rate moves that will bring the short-term interest rates that banks charge each other to 2.5% at the end of this year. In other words, 3 half-point rises followed by 3 quarter-point rises. Now, is there any guarantee that that'll happen? No, because as they have said, and as the chairman has said, it's data-driven. If inflation starts to fall off, they'll raise interest rates less quickly. But they're still going to get back to around 2.5% to get to neutral. What is neutral? Well, neutral means the Fed is no longer stimulating the economy. This is the interesting point, considering what the bears in the market are saying right now. What the Federal Reserve has concluded is, as long as the interbank interest rate, the short-term interest rates at which banks loan each other money, is set below 2.4%, it is stimulating the economy. It isn't putting the brakes on. It isn't slowing things down. It isn't retarding growth. It is still stimulating the economy. 2.4, they've gone to neutral.
Let's explain that. Just a second. Say you're a small business. You say,
I am a small business.
Okay, you're a small business. You want to expand and you need a widget maker immediately. It is a widget enameler. It puts enamel on widgets for you and then embroiders it.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a very nice.
I do need to get one of those.
Right. And you go, I could start making a profit on this fairly quickly. It's a large expense. But if I go to the bank right now, the interest rate's too high. I'm actually not going to make a profit immediately. It's going to eat into my profit. It's maybe break even. That's neutral. If you go to buy a solar panel to put on your roof, and you say, I'm going to save $100 a month on average over the year on my electricity bill, and your loan payment is $80 a month, that's stimulative. That means that you just made $20 a month by taking a loan.
Mm.
And if that interest rate goes up a little bit so that it's right at $100, you're spending the same thing that you would have before. You're spending $100 on a loan instead of $100 on electricity, but the idea is at the end of the loan, you get this deal. So the profitability is pushed into the distance. That's neutral. When it costs more to put the thing on your roof than to pay the electricity, people stop buying the thing on the roof.
And it slows the economy down.
That's going to slow the economy, correct.
Right.
So that's
the. The 3.5 or 3.6% rate comes from the fact that there's also been a lot of discussion about the fact of what happens if inflation has become entrenched by then, and we have a wage price spiral like we had in the late 1970s and 1980 and 81 and so on. Then the Fed would have to raise interest rates probably another percentage point up around 3.6%, 3.5, 3.6%, and actually put the brakes on in the economy. Folks, if that happens, you go ahead and mark it on your calendar that Jeff said so, we'll have a recession. Because once the Fed actually starts putting on the brakes to stop a runaway economy, the tires are going to skid and there's going to be smoke and the vehicle will probably come to a complete stop, or it will slow down a lot, maybe even go backwards, which is what a recession is. On the other hand, there is a pretty reasonable probability, I would go so far as to say better than a 50% probability, and that's just a gut reaction on Jeff's part, that we will not have to have the Fed put the brakes on. I think by the time they get back to neutral, combined with the shrinking of their balance sheet, it's called, which means that they basically are selling bonds in the market and raising longer-term rates, economic activity will have slowed down to the point that the economy can continue to move forward without a recession. Now, as our representative John Carter so blatantly said on Friday through his letter, some economists are calling for a recession that says we are definitely going to have a recession. Well, if you followed the link and you checked it out, it's the economists in Germany that are saying that the U.S. is going to have a recession.
Yeah, because the Germans are actually likely to have a recession.
Right. They really know what's going on in the United States. Actually, if you then looked further down the article, you would find out that Goldman Sachs, who has probably a little better feeling for what goes on in the United States because they're in the United States, are saying that they don't think so, maybe a 30% chance of a recession next year. So basically, if you don't, the party that's not in the White House at this particular moment will always say bad times are coming. And the party that is in the White House is generally going to say good times are coming. So those are not the most reliable places to look. There's a probably better than 50% chance that we'll get out of this without a recession. Why do I say that? Because Americans have a lot of cash. We have a very, very high employment rate. We are hiring people at a high rate of speed. This indicates our economy, and economies do have this, has a lot of momentum.
Yeah.
So you can kick the gear, you can kick the gearbox into neutral, and we could coast a long way. And remember, the Fed is not the engine that drives the economy. The engine that drives our economy is you and me and us. It is the consumer. And we've just had consumer spending jump at 3.7% annualized in the first quarter of the year.
That's higher than inflation.
That is huge.
For when we're talking about that same, like the core inflation, that consumer spending is going up faster than inflation is. That's part of what's leading to inflation. But it's also, as soon as we get the supply chains ironed out, expect prices to fall. That's very normal.
So there's a couple of things going on. One, consumer spending remains very, very healthy and very high and is charging forward very nicely, which is a good thing. Cash balances are in really good shape in the American households. Debt levels are very low. All of these are indicators that we have a lot of positive growth left in the economy, which is why I'll say right now, I'm going to make a forecast. Now, forecasts are like weather forecasts. They're only probabilities. So I'm not saying this is an absolute certainty. There are no certainties. I don't think we're going to have a bear market at this moment. And I don't think we're going to have a recession anytime soon, because the signs that have preceded such things in the past are not there. Just that simple.
Yeah.
Leading
economic indicators are up. This is an index. It's a fantastic index that historically there has never been a recession that wasn't predicted by the leading indicators dropping in advance. They're not dropping. We're seeing growth there. We see consumer spending. We see, and this is where I said I was going to bring this in. We just have a few minutes for it, but I was down at the coast this last week, which is why I missed the program. We had a great best of program that was played for us. Thanks, Rio. The whole concept of what's happening in the oil and natural gas world, I saw tankers lined up as far as I could see out into the ocean, waiting to come into port to load up on petroleum and liquid natural gas to take it to the rest of the world. And the ships were coming in about every 5 minutes, which means that the wake had only just had, it was still there from the last ship when the next ship was coming. The traffic out there, the way they're keeping the speed up is just amazing. They're not packing it in faster than every 5 minutes, because that would actually slow things down. They are at about the peak amount of ships that they can get in and out at a time. And there's a line waiting as far out as you can see. That's a tremendous amount of wealth transfer to United States companies, which leads to wealth transfer to United States shareholders and United States employees. This is a really big, big thing. The corn market, the wheat market, the sunflower market, the canola market, all of these things are having a massive gain based on the troubles of the rest of the world. And we're experiencing price hikes based on that, but it's still, the benefit is mostly being kept here. And we're about out of time for this hour. I've got more to talk about the coast next hour. But if you'd like to talk to us off the air, we actually give customized investment advice, fiduciary investment advice to people of relatively high net worth. The phone number locally to get that, there's voicemail on the weekends. Real Live People on the Week is
254-947-1111.
You can reach that toll free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com if you're lazy like me. You can read our newsletters going back. You can sign up for the newsletter. You can listen to our radio program going back lots of years. See what we said before. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.